original morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Friday night and Sunday afternoon, the Milwaukee Florentine And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Friday night and Sunday afternoon, the Milwaukee Florentine presents the world premiere performances of a brand new opera by Robert Aldridge and Herschel Garfein, Sister Carrie, based on the classic Theodore Dreiser novel. I spoke with composer Robert Aldridge and asked how this invitation from the Milwaukee Florentine came about.
Well, it actually, about 6.5 years ago, when Elmer Gantry was being done in Milwaukee by the Florentine Opera Company and recorded in a disc that ultimately was released by Naxos and then won the 2 Grammy Awards, we met in the night between performances of Elmer Gantry. Herschel and I met with the company head, Bill Florescu, and pitched the idea of our next opera, which was Sister Carrie. And Herschel and I had sort of discovered this book and then reread it. And it's one of those, Sister Carrie is one of those books that 40, 50 years ago, everybody had to read as a part of their literary education. And it's sort of fallen out of that category now as a book that must read. Dreiser was an important American novelist, maybe the first important urban American novelist. And it was published in 1900. Sister Carrie was his first novel and led to great acclaim for Dreiser. But we had discovered it and thought it was perfect for opera for lots of reasons. And we approached Bill Florescu about this, and the next day he told me he uploaded it on his Kindle, and we were off to the races. We did some workshops on it in the succeeding time, and Bill was always very supportive, and then at some point this led to an official commissioning of the work, maybe 3 or 4 years ago. He liked it enough that he signed an official commission, Florentine commissioning Herschel and I to do it and to be published by my publisher, C.F. Peters, who also did Elmer Gantry. So it's been a very happy development for the last 6.5 years.
So what was it about this novel, which undeniably is a great novel and a very important novel, but not all great novels necessarily should be transformed into operas. What was it about this that made both of you think, and Mr. Florescu ultimately as well, that this novel would was fertile ground for creating a wonderful opera?
Well, Herschel and I always look for big themed works. I mean, Elmer Gantry was nothing if not a sort of large-scale grand opera of big American themes. And Sister Carrie is similar to that, very different, because Elmer Gantry had a lot to do with sort of the rural Midwest and God and, a title character to sort of the American Don Giovanni. In this is a very urban tale. It takes place in Chicago and New York. It deals a lot with industrialization and exploitation of factory workers and the working class in urban Chicago and New York in 1900. And then, it has a wonderful romance at its heart. It has betrayal. It has deceit. It has madness and ultimately suicide of the main male character, all the while Carrie, the title character, is on the rise in her career and ultimately is starring in a Broadway show at the same time as the main character, Hurstwood, and her ex-husband is turned on the gas in his shabby hotel room in New York. So we thought it was kind of a perfect novel in many ways, not least because most operas deal with female characters who go mad and are killed or commit suicide. In this case, the male characters have that sad fate while Carrie goes on to great acclaim. So we thought it was great that a female character comes out on top
right.
in our that was a nice inversion of the what is the normal operatic convention.
Right. As far as you know, has this ever been converted into an opera before, or is your opera the first?
No, I mean, I'm quite sure it's the first. I was surprised with Sister Carrie, as I was with Elmer Gantry, that no one had done an opera based on it, because it really, both stories sort of cry out for operatic treatment, and we were delighted to find out that no one was doing it, or was planning to do it. So that gave us, that emboldened us even further to go for it in terms of writing and adapting Elmer and Sister Carrie. And Herschel, once again, has done an outstanding job, brilliant job of converting the book to an opera libretto.
Composer Robert Aldridge. Now let's talk with librettist Herschel Garfein, with whom Mr. Aldridge scored such a great success with their first opera, Elmer Gantry. I asked Mr. Garfein to explain how they could score such a great success with their initial collaboration.
Right. Well, actually, I think that it's such a difficult genre to work in, and it takes such a long time, and it takes so much commitment from all the parties involved that, honestly, what I think it comes down to is you really have to care about the subject and the story that you're trying to tell, you know, because it's going to take, you know, even under the best of circumstances, and I'll explain in a minute why Elmer Gantry was not exactly written under the best of circumstances. But, you know, even that, let's say you get a huge commission and a lot of money from an opera company, and you have a team of, you know, dozens of people working on your behalf to ready the thing for production and all that. Well, still, it's going to take you, you know, a year, 2 years, 3 years to write this piece. And every day that you wake up and have to work on that thing, you better continue to believe in it in the way you did when you first conceived of the idea. So I think the key to success in opera is to find the right project, find the right property, the right story that really needs to be told operatically, and then work like crazy to find the way to do that correctly. And, you know, you very kindly mentioned the acclaim that Elmer Gantry received, but that opera sat dormant for 17 years. We had done two very complete workshops of it in Boston, where Bob and I first met and first collaborated, and then an opera company that had agreed to premiere it backed out of that agreement, and we were sort of pariahs in the opera world. We had this massive opera, you know, including chorus, and a three-hour opera including chorus and big orchestra, and, you know, written on a great American novel, et cetera, et cetera. And we tried unsuccessfully to sort of peddle it around the country. And it was only then, you know, after a great long period of time, when we had basically given up on it ever being produced, where we went back and one more time, just for our own satisfaction, we decided that we would perfect that we would work very hard on it and get it right and put it on the shelf for posterity. And so, you know, when it was picked up and done by, it was first done by Nashville Opera, and then it was done by the Peak Performances in New Jersey, and then Bill Florescu, the artistic director of Florentine Opera, came along and actually gave it its crucial second production, which then led to the two Grammy Awards you alluded to. But when all that happened, it was the realization of such a long-standing dream that the acclaim was almost secondary. Mm. But getting it done after all that work was really the triumph. So now with Sister Carrie, it's a different story. We're Mr. Florescu, after the success of Elmer Gantry, came to us immediately afterwards and said, you know, what do you want to do for your next thing? And so this one has gone really very, very smoothly by comparison. We've had the pleasure of merely struggling on it in artistic ways and not struggling to try to get it done. Mm. And so that's a great luxury.
Right.
And we're very excited about it.
Tell us about the circumstances under which you first met Robert Aldridge, And was it one of those instances in which you both knew instantly that we were meant to work together?
I think it was about as far from that as you could ever be. actually, we were, you know, I'm primarily a composer myself. And so we both went to New England Conservatory in Boston for graduate school in composition. And then we were both sort of freelancers, let's say, in Boston, freelance composers, you know, achieving some success on our own. And we were just colleagues. We met as colleagues. We actually were slightly competitive with each other. And I remember some of our first meetings were actually a little bit rocky because I think we both, you know, we were in our early 20s. And at that stage, you sort of identify the people around you that you might consider to be rivals, you know, who are talented. And you don't exactly get along famously with those people. So I think we both heard, you know, some of each other's music and liked it. And therefore, we were a little bit cool with each other. And but over the years, then, you know, we as we gained an admiration for each other's work, you know, then we finally, you know, actually, again, it was Bob's idea, but I had started writing some texts for myself. I'd never tried a full-length libretto, but he approached me with this, with the idea of Elmer Gantry. So it has been, it's been a long time and a very, very fruitful relationship, yeah.
I was certainly aware of the fact that you were a composer, and I've had the pleasure of hearing a number of your songs. But honestly, it hadn't really dawned on me the potentially awkward position that that places you in terms of being a librettist, of at least in one way kind of suppressing a really important part of who you are, in a sense suppressing one of your most significant gifts in order to let somebody else be the composer while you limit yourself to writing the words. Although I suspect that it maybe isn't exactly that scenario. I suspect that, at least in some subtle ways, you are still a composer at heart as you lay out this libretto. I mean, you are already thinking as a composer about trying to create words that sort of invite music to be created for them. Can you talk about that position?
Sure, yeah, I would actually go much farther than what you just said. I think what you first described in terms of suppressing anything was definitely the case, but that was the case, I mean, decades ago, honestly. And at this point, you know, I do write for other composers. I write words for other composers. And I write words for myself. And you know, and so often I'm in the situation of doing both. So I really, honestly, you know, the honest answer is, to me, there's very, very little distinction between the two at this point. I mean, I've done it so long that they seem to be part of the same process. And I think one reason for that is that I come from a theater background, a dramatic background. And so in the work that I do, both on my own and with Bob and with my other collaborators, I think we always are proceeding from a dramatic foundation in the work we do. So, for example, the true answer to the question that we're always asked, let's say at talkback sessions and all that, when Bob and I are, you know, presenting a work, you know, which comes first, the words or the music? Well, technically, the words come before the music, but something comes before either one, and that's the drama. And because of that, because we're both working from that basis, it's really not an issue anymore about what I might. I don't even really hear exactly in my head, you know, my own melodies or something as people expect that I would. It really doesn't come up. Instead, what we do is we talk a great deal. And we think on our own about what the dramatic underpinnings of a story are and the dramatic underpinnings of each individual scene. And then I begin to write words for Bob, and then we spend a great deal of time back and forth, a lot of time. I mean, it's really like the sort of the model of the old Broadway songwriters, where I send him some words, he sets them to music, we see how far that takes us. So So if a musical idea hatches for him, in response to those words, then he points that out to me, or it's obvious to me, he doesn't even have to point it out. And then, you know, it comes back to me. What we've got, the work we've got comes back to me, and I try to expand upon that in ways that will allow him to pursue musically what he has in mind. So because I'm a composer, when those musical ideas develop, we can talk about them musically, even in the shadowy way that you talk about things that aren't quite done yet. I'm used to that because I'm used to those all those shadowy contemplations in my own work. And so I think that that is what allows us to proceed, you know, slowly, but quite in great accordance, you know, in real understanding of where we're going, you know, mutual understanding.
So honestly, as you are writing certain words for this libretto or Elmer Gantry or in other cases, you don't find in your own head very often the music that you would write in order to set those?
No, I honestly don't. I used to. But now, you know, as I've worked more and more as a lyricist for myself and for others, what I've started to feel instead of that, to sort of sense instead of that, is the kind of, the fall of words themselves, the sounds, the vowels, the scansion, and that sort of makes a kind of skeleton in my head. It's not a very accurate word, but it gives me some kind of a sense in my head of what could be musicalized. But the way in which it will be musicalized, my mind doesn't really go there now. I'm very happy feeling the sort of the fall of those words one after the another. And, you know, I guess I probably have an instinctive sense of hundreds of musical elements that don't even have to, I don't even have to explicitly examine. Like, for example, I have an inherent sense of the upbeat and the downbeat, you know, without even thinking about it. So as I'm trying to express something, or as I'm thinking of having a character, you know, I'm trying to find the words that a character would use to sing something, I'm probably unconsciously making a lot of judgments about the scansion, about upbeats and downbeats and stresses and lovely long vowels and kind of expressive guttural vowels and things like that don't even rise to the conscious level.
Right. We're speaking with Herschel Garfein, and he is the librettist for the opera that receives its world premiere this weekend at the Milwaukee Florentine, an operatic treatment of a very, very important novel by the name of Sister Carrie, a novel from over 100 years ago. We should probably talk about this particular novel and what makes it made it such an attractive possibility for you and Mr. Aldridge to transform into an opera. Because I think most people would agree that it's not enough for a novel to be wonderful and compelling and exciting for it to be necessarily the stuff from which an opera should be constructed. But you clearly saw something in Sister Carrie that you thought was important. Tell our listeners, first of all, a little bit about the novel and why you thought it was ripe for operatic treatment.
Fantastic. Yeah, I'd like to start off by saying it's called Sister Carrie. It is not about a nun. And perhaps you could take those words that I've just spoken and put them at the top of this clip so that everybody knows that it is not about a nun. And curiously enough, you know, Dreiser, at the time that the novel was published, he was roundly criticized for calling it that, because some of the critics, even at the time, said, you know, it's a great novel except for the title, which makes everyone think it's about a nun.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, it's not about a nun, and it's one of these great books, actually, in a way, similar to Sinclair Lewis's Elmer Gantry, which was, of course, our last opera. It's one of these great books that, in our literary heritage as Americans, that's often neglected in the present day. I would suppose that 30 or 40 years ago, it was part of every high school or college curriculum. I myself read it in when I was in college, but it wasn't assigned to me. I just read it on my own for the first time. And you know, Dreiser is one of our great novelists, especially because he was one of the great American social realists. And I say social advisedly, he was also a passionate lifelong socialist. And he looked at various aspects of American life with a very critical eye, and a very unflinching, you know, he had an unflinching desire to look at how our society worked, and you know, still continues to work in without prettifying it in any way. And I think that was what most attracted us to the book. I will say that it also, for me as a librettist, it was rather terrifying. It was, you know, I reread the book several times. Bob brought the idea to me. And of course, you know, I remembered the book quite vividly. And I was very excited by the idea, but then once I went back and read it again, I have to say that I was quite dejected. And you know, I think it's been about 5 years that we've been working on it, maybe 5 or 6 years. And in those 5 years, I have to admit to you, Gregory, that a couple of times I asked to be let off the hook. We would get together, we would go out for a cup of coffee or a drink, and I would say, Bob, I've really tried here. I know I've already written some things that are quite good, and you've set them to music that I think is lovely, but let me out of this one. It's just too difficult. It was a very daunting book to approach.
And you were saying that in all seriousness?
Oh, in absolute seriousness. I mean, as I said when we started this interview, I don't take operas lightly. I don't embark on one that I don't think I can really see through, and that I really feel, you know, opera is such a difficult form. It's so expensive, and it requires the efforts of so many people. I feel like one really has literally a moral responsibility to make sure that the things you put up there on stage really work and really will illuminate something for people and will really further the genre of opera. Otherwise, you know, do it in some other way. Don't just do it, you know. I don't feel that opera should be experimental, in quotes, in that way. They shouldn't experiment with their own, you know, possible failure.
Right.
they have to work. So for various kinds of reasons, I think the thing was that the book is very ponderous. It's very long. It's very detailed about a lot of things that honestly, you know, to the modern reader at least, don't really justify that level of detail. You know, for example, he'll look at the way that a successful man seduces a young, poor girl. But he'll look at it in such, you know, extensive detail. It'll take 5 chapters and 6 chapters of him telling you exactly what's going on in the mind of the man, not so much the woman, by the way, but all this sort of thing. And so the cumulative result can be a little bit melodramatic. Overall, yes, the book is full of fascinating detail. It tells a really compelling story, and it tells it in these kind of very stark sociological terms. All of that's very good, but it was both the heavy plot of the book and its tendency towards melodrama that was off-putting towards me.
Hmm.
Yeah,
I have to say, when I think about the last 10 modern operas that I have seen, Elmer Gantry is one of them that I really liked a lot, but the vast majority I have not particularly cared for, and in almost every instance, it was at least as much the fault of the libretto as it was the score.
Yeah.
And in probably most cases, it was the libretto that I thought was the real mess. And I think one of the most disturbing trends has been for the responsibility of creating an opera libretto to be given to somebody who simply doesn't know what they're doing. I mean, and just because you're a poet, or just because you're a novelist or a screenwriter or whatever, does not mean you know what it takes to put together.
No, that's right. In fact, it might disqualify you
in some ways.
Well, because I mean, what I often find is that with some, there's some notable exceptions. I think there's some people out there who are writing excellent libretti, but the problem is that you know, even the very talented writer, the very talented poet, trying to write a libretto, you know, they don't really see themselves as serving the music the way that I do, because I'm a composer. And, you know, because I'm a composer, I recognize that the words, important as they are not as important as the music, in the sense that the words have to be able to work musically, and they have to be sung. And you know, it's no small thing that Bob and I approach the opera form as, you know, as unapologetically a collection of arias. I mean, opera is sung drama. It's drama in song. It's not drama in recitative. It's not drama in, you know, quasi singing. It's not chanting. It's not, you know, leaping all over the staff and making a bunch of sounds. It is singing. And so we always approach it that way, and we have to find stories that we feel that can be told in song, and then a style in which the characters can express themselves in song. And all of that is crucial, and in a way it's more important than the actual words that are written, although, you know, I take a great deal of care with the words that I'm writing, but I never forget that I'm writing songs. I'm writing, you know, a vastly extended song form when I'm writing an opera.
And, of course, one of the challenges you faced in transforming this particular novel into an opera libretto is that it takes longer to sing words than to speak them. So,
right.
You know, probably just to turn the novel itself into an opera without cutting it, would have turned it into another Ring cycle or something. I mean, it would have been a massive,
it's
massive.
It's impossible. You can't. Right. Anything that you turn into an opera has to be cut. And I don't even think of it necessarily as cutting. I think of it as concentrating. There are only you know, a handful or a double handful of key incidents within the novel that can end up in the opera. And so one has to take those and concentrate their motives, concentrate their meanings down to the point where they can be sung about, you know. And then it's from those materials that you create the opera. To start and think that you're taking a book of some 800 pages and merely cutting out 400, 600, you know, 700 of them in order to make your opera is not really the way it goes. It really is that the book presents its own universe. You try as much as hard as you can to penetrate into that universe, to understand those characters, to see what the key incidents of the book are, and then it's a vast a translation process. You have to make it into an entirely different form.
So as this world premiere approaches, I assume that by now the responsibility of this is mostly shed. And I mean, the hard work of Sister Carrie is now someone else's hard work in terms of perfecting the performances that are about to be delivered. And you just
right.
get to sit in the audience and enjoy it along with the rest of us. Is that right?
That's basically right. I mean, you know, one extraordinary feature of this particular collaboration with Florentine Opera and Bill Florescu, who's the general director of Florentine Opera and the stage director of Sister Carrie, is that now, you know, we the three of us, Bill and Bob and I, we really share a certain kind of outlook on operatic work. And so, you know, we did a workshop about 2 years ago in Milwaukee that was extremely important for us, and it was the point at which I really turned the corner, and I stopped seeing the flaws in the possible melodramatic flaws in the story, and really figured out how to make the whole thing sing, you know, the way that I really want, I want audiences to sense the reality of these characters and who they are, and not that they're in some very, very pointed melodramatic tale, because I don't think they are. But at any rate, so, you know, once Bill Florescu got behind this project and, you know, commissioned it, he also, you know, was determined to formulate the whole thing in a way that really responds to the kind of work that Bob and I do. So we're thrilled to be working with two singers. Well, the whole cast is great, but we have the two singers in our lead who, to a great extent, the opera is really built around are Adriana Zabala as Sister Carrie and Keith Fares as Hurstwood. And we both worked with them. Bob and I have worked with both of them, you know, individually and together for, you know, for 12, 15 years. And so we know them. We wrote these parts for them. They know us. They know what we're going for and the way that we like the, you know, the action between the characters to be very, very clear, and all of the meanings of those actions to be under the surface for those who care to find them, but that the surface of the opera has to be very, very dynamic and very entertaining, and Bill Florescu understands this too. So it's a very, very happy collaboration in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know a lot of opera fans here in southeastern Wisconsin are eagerly awaiting the world premiere of Sister Carrie at the Florentine. I want to ask you about the fact that my understanding is that another work that is in process will be an operatic treatment of Tom Stoppard's Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead.
And, yes, that's,
and
that's right.
That's a play that was recently done at the college where I teach, so I am quite intrigued by this. And this is a project, I believe, where you will be both the composer, or are both the composer and librettist.
That's right. And in fact, it's, the opera is done. I'm just the piano vocal score is done, and I'm just orchestrating at the moment. But in fact, your question comes at the perfect time, because I just received some very good news that it's going to be done at a very, very fine summer music festival, the Segal Colony in upstate New York, SEAGLE, which is run by Darren Woods, who's the artistic director of Fort Worth Opera. And it's a very notable summer program. They get some of the best young singers, you know, undergrads and grads from around the country. And they're going to be doing four fully staged performances of Elmer Gantry. It's going to be not the world premiere, because there's no orchestra, but it's going to be the piano vocal premiere of that work in July 2017.
What has that felt like to be creating an opera where there isn't someone else with which you are in collaboration, with whom you're sort of bouncing off your own ideas and reacting to what they've done? Has it been simpler? Has it been, in a sense, emptier? Has it been strange? What has this experience been like?
No, I mean, I love working on my own, and so it's not been in any way, you know, solitary, except in the best possible way. No, it's the, like the culmination of a very, very long, you know, ardent dream of mine. So I couldn't be happier about that.
Librettist Herschel Garfein. Now we talk to conductor William Boggs, who will be leading these performances of Sister Carrie this weekend, just as he led the performances of Elmer Gantry at the Milwaukee Florentine. Tell us how you would describe this musical score, and in particular, Mr. Aldridge's sort of musical language. And it might be helpful if you compare this score to Elmer Gantry, which some of our listeners will already be familiar with.
Well, I think Bob is first of all, he's extraordinary. He's an American composer. I really feel Americana in him. Now, that's not to diminish the European brilliance of what he does and Western classical music, but I mean, he fits in. If you build a house of rooms that all had the same aesthetic, the rooms would be Bernstein, Copland, Gershwin, Aldridge. I mean, he fits right in with that feeling. It's very visceral. It's very rhythmic. It's extraordinarily lyric and tuneful. There's so many new pieces that, frankly, I have no tolerance for, because they're so un-lyric and unmelodic. Bob writes beautifully melodic material, so when you come out you will have heard tunes that have affected you that you want to hum. You will hum some things to yourself, and that's not sort of say that they're trite. They're just extraordinarily Puccinian. In fact, I compare him to Puccini. He's a modern-day Puccini. He gets right to the fact, and it's melodically just scrumptious. And so that's I just think of Bob as a cross between Gershwin and Puccini.
Hmm. One thing I find intriguing is that you have conducted at the Florentine Elmer Gantry and about to conduct Sister Carrie, and in between those two, Giulio Cesare, Julius Caesar by George Frederick Handel, a work from the Baroque period, more than two centuries old. It must be sort of odd to, on the one hand, conduct a work that has been around for such a long time, which you, I'm sure, had some kind of acquaintance even before you started concertedly studying it in order to conduct it, versus something that, a score that, in a sense, nobody knows because it hasn't been here yet. Just on kind of a emotional and visceral level, how different a feeling is that for you as the conductor to be conducting something utterly brand new?
Right. It's really exciting. Because it's literally, as Bob has a blank page and Herschel to start a piece, when we get the music, it's a blank. Even though there are a lot of notes there, it's blank. It's never been interpreted. And it's very funny, Bob, early on, and this is Elmer Gantry, our first experience, gosh, we were on a note session on the phone. I was at my desk at home looking through the score, and there were mistakes in the score, so we're proofing things and going through. And about the fourth or fifth time, Bob gave me a tempo indication change, like, instead of 132, I want 144 or 126, just numbers. And I stopped and said, Bob, we don't know each other yet, but just so you know, these numbers mean absolutely nothing to me. Until I meet the cast and we make this, bring this music alive, that will determine the exact tempo. And by the way, a different cast will take it differently. And you got to know, as an opera conductor, I study and then I bring it and then I work with the people I have to bring the best out. So with a piece like Handel, you can listen to, innumerable recordings of great cast and how they interpreted it, and you learn some things from that, but it doesn't matter when it comes to your cast and your production. So Bob had to learn that about opera, that really it isn't, we don't try to recreate exactly what happened last time. You take the cast you have and how do they sound the best and still get out the essence of what the composer and librettist wanted. So it's a fascinating process, and Bob has learned to be flexible, and trust me, that I'm listening to the singers, and so it's what he imagined. Now we've got other minds imagining too. You've got to let the baby go to school and grow up and study from a teacher and learn other things. You know, it's hard to let the baby go. Like, no, I want it to be perfectly this way. A child will grow up in their own way, and a piece kind of does that in its own way.
Wow.
With the different artists doing it. And that's kind of an exciting process.
Of course. That's very well said. Sure. Scary for the composer, especially. Right.
And the other thing I would say, the pressure on a world premiere, it's not, yes, it's world premiere, but it's a performance for an audience. You want to do the best you can. But I tell people, I there's nothing I could do. If I did the world's worst performance of Madame Butterfly, the piece will still be around. I can't hurt Madame Butterfly or Puccini. But on a world premiere, if I do a horrible job, this Aldridge may not get done again, because when they hear, they say, well, gosh, I don't like that. So the pressure for the singers and the cast members are, we love this music. We want to do the best we can because we want it to be heard again.
Hmm.
We want to do service to Bob and Herschel because of this great creation they've given us. So the pressure is that our commitment is, we want to make sure it gets done. And so we have to bring the best we have, musicality, vocalism, acting, everything to it so that it lives on. And that's the fun part and the scary part, that we believe in it.
How much of the responsibility of teaching this brand new score to the singers is yours?
Well, in a 3-week process, that's a world premiere. That's insane. It truly is insane. You know, in Europe, they would take a world premiere would have 6 or 8 weeks at least. You know, and you'd have 3 weeks of music before you even think about staging. But these the Bill for Rescue hire such great people. They came in knowing the role. I mean, absolutely, they have coached and really worked at it. Everyone has, or it never would have worked. I mean, they're total professionals. They came in prepared to go. Now, having said that, you don't know how it fits together. You know your lines, you've memorized, you know what your notes are and your lines, your rhythm. But when you put it together, you react totally differently once you hear what's around you. And that happens during rehearsals. So they have to be quick on their feet. And so I'm really shaping, more than teaching the notes, I'm shaping how they interpret that line and musically how we successfully blend to get the meaning out of it. So mine is really is negotiating and moving things around and getting them to buy into to what I hear as an overall arc where they know their arc.
Hmm.
You know, so it really has to be about that.
Right. A last question.
Sure.
I think a lot of people are really astounded by the tremendous success that Mr. Aldridge and Mr. Garfine scored with their very first opera. I mean, such a complicated genre, and there are so many ways in which the kind of complicated balancing act that really is part of creating a great opera, so much can go awry, and so much went right with Elmer Gantry. And are you as astounded as a lot of other people are that even right out of the starting gate with their very first opera, they were able to score such a triumphant success?
You know, isn't that interesting? Because, you know, 150 years ago, 200 years ago, composers put out a lot of music, and we don't play all of their music. We know the great pieces. But they got, you know, if they had a symphony that didn't go well, they got a chance to write three or four or five more before they had a hit and still get produced. With opera, to come out of the box with your first show, you don't get seven or eight operas to really find out if you can compose an opera. You get one. And somehow these gentlemen found some magic, whether it's their talent, their innate sensibilities, but they came out with a great show right out of the box, and that's extraordinary. You know, Mozart's Bastien and Bastienne is not the world, that's not something you're going to spend $120 to go see in a theater. It's a lovely little opera, but from a first-time composer, we get the marriage of Figaro, Giovanni, you know, Magic Flute, late in his career, the real fruition of all this incredible talent. They had to come out the first time and nail it, and they did. And that's a great question. I'm not sure how they did it, but it is extraordinary. And Bob's music is just, his clarinet concerto with Copland's clarinet concerto. I think I like Bob Aldridge's better, and I love Copland. You know, he's just an extraordinary composer, and I think that's part of it. But I think a lot of people helped him, and they listened, and they kept working and refining, and I think that's part of it.
Maestro William Boggs will be on the podium leading this weekend's world premiere performances of Sister Carrie Friday night and Sunday afternoon at the Milwaukee Florentine Opera. Taking on the title role will be up-and-coming mezzo-soprano Adriana Zabala, who will be known to Florentine audiences for her delightful performances as Cherubino in Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro. So tell us about this character of Carrie and what kind of special challenges and opportunities she has, in a sense, presented to you.
Yeah. Well, I would say that one of the most salient and fun challenges of the role and what one would experience if you come to the show, which I hope anyone who's listening does come to the show, is that my character, even though we're not necessarily identifying a specific period of time that passes from the beginning of the opera to the end of the opera, my character nonetheless undergoes a serious transformation. The kind that you see at the beginning of, I don't know, something like one of those reality shows where someone has a challenge to become something different, and then 9 weeks later there's the reveal and they've become something very different. You watch that kind of thing happen to Carrie in every scene, incrementally, and sometimes it's two steps forward and sometimes it's a big leap forward. And what I mean by that is that she arrives in Chicago, a young woman who doesn't necessarily know yet that she's got stars in her eyes, but the people she meets and the circumstances that she encounters start to make her realize she's got some serious dreams and ambition and seems to be made for something different than what she had imagined growing up. And so she arrives at the beginning something like, if you want to think of bookend extreme, kind of like a Laura Ingalls Wilder. And by the time the opera finishes, she's like Hello Dolly. I mean, she really, really undergoes an entire transformation of style and of attitude and confidence and self-awareness. And that's not to say she doesn't make she makes some emotional wagers along the way. And to the extent that one could consider that she succeeds or that she has attained success at the end, she has also paid a price for that success and finds herself somewhat isolated and in an ambiguous kind of state of having achieved what might be material success, but a difficult emotional path, especially vis-a-vis the relationship with George Hurstwood, the key figure in her emotional trajectory. And as she is on the rise to this, as I'm saying, supposed success, he, who begins in an enfranchised, successful, confident kind of circumstance, really, really tragically degenerates into just an abyss that's very painful and heartbreaking to experience.
Mezzo-soprano Adriana Zabala takes on the title role of Sister Carrie this weekend at the Milwaukee Florentine. Opposite her will be the young, celebrated baritone Keith Ferris, who made such an impression with his performance at the Florentine of the title role of Elmer Gantry. In this opera, he performs the tragic role of Hurstwood, a successful middle-class man who throws everything away in pursuit of Carrie. One challenge that you have as the person portraying him is to make him a character that isn't, in a sense, too pathetic or too ridiculous or too irritating. I mean, somebody whom we find compelling and for whom we feel at least a certain amount of sympathy or empathy. Do you feel like the way this role has been constructed by both the composer and the librettist, that is possible?
Yes, I do. And contrary to Elmer Gantry, you see a very human side of him. I mean, that's written into the part. You know, he knows what he's done. He knows that what he's done is wrong. I mean, in the moment, he proceeds as though, you know, this is the solution. But, you know, he has regret, he has guilt, he has remorse. That's evident. And he's never malicious. I don't think he bears any malice towards anyone. But yeah, he does get lost. He does get lost. And you know, to the end of the opera, he still, you know, of course he still has Carrie on his mind. And he does, you know, and to the idea of like how to keep from making him look too pathetic. I mean, you know, he does try to get work. He finally does try to get work, and that's it. That's more apparent in the book. In the book, he goes out repeatedly to try to find work. Just doesn't take rejection very well, and I think there are plenty of people that can relate to that. You know, not everyone takes rejection well,
right?
But that's the thing about this, you know, this novel and this opera. I mean, the statement that it's trying to make is how this whole idea of conspicuous consumption and the need to keep up with everybody else and terms of your clothes or your status or this and that, you know, that becomes a character of its own.
Right.
And so that's what he's dealing with. He's an example of somebody who is ruining his life because of this same kind of, you know, I think this same kind of, call it a sickness, that like a lot of people have, where there's that need to you know, amass things and stuff and to feel like you're whole, to feel like you're a real person.
Baritone Keith Ferris. For more information about the performances this weekend of Sister Carrie, you can go to FlorentineOpera.org or call 414-291-5700. I'm Gregory Berg.